Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. And when we're talking about mind power today, we're going to trip the mind fantastic. Yes, that's exactly what we're going to do, because we're going to enter into the world of science fiction. I don't know about any of you, but sci-fi like Star Trek, Star Wars, Jules Verne's material, H.G. Wells, sci-fi I have always been fascinated with, primarily because often the writers of science fiction are way ahead of the curve. For some reason, through their worlds of imagination, they dip into cosmic soup that enables us to perhaps see what future possibilities are available to us, good, bad, or indifferent. My guest, Robert Harkin, is one of those people. And this is a book, Life on Nubis, that I really think is a very challenging book to read in some respects, because it's going to stretch your mind and your imagination into directions that you may or may not have even considered. I want to welcome to the show Robert Harkin. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Donna.
You're a man that has a very interesting perception on the possibilities of life. Was there something that your mother put in your milk that made you think out of the box the way you do?
Yeah, it could be. I was too young to know, but it's interesting because my mother was also very creative, and you see my sister is visually creative as well. And I, myself, am an associative creative. I like pulling together lots of pieces of information from different parts of the world to make new things.
Well, your background is what I would say is a very linear background. Your book, Life on Nubis, is so creative. It is so unique, yet because of your background, which includes an undergraduate degree in wildlife management from Virginia Tech, and you got involved with recycling. You then became a Juris Doctor from William & Mary. You went into corporate mergers, acquisitions. You got into investment management. You were successful as an investor, and you were a chartered financial analyst. And you just got a master's in, you know, a master's in business, and yet life on Nubis is so far away from yet you did incorporate a lot of the things that you learned, but you found that you weren't really happy with what you were doing. Why not? You had so many things that were going so well for you, financially and otherwise. What created the mental itch that you found you had to scratch and you needed to move forward into a whole new genre?
Well, I've always felt a need to make a positive difference with my life and influence the world in a good way, and I'm driven to teach what I learned. And I never really considered writing until the ebook revolution kind of sparked my interest. But when I started fiction writing, and I'd done a lot of business and technical writing, but when I started fiction writing, I found that I really enjoyed it, and it surprised me. And it also filled my needs to teach what I've learned, and also to make a positive difference. But there's the motivation for writing the book actually came from my daughter. I was driving her to school one day, and she asked me what she should do when she's grown. And after 5 minutes of stumbling through my hard-learned life lessons, all I was able to get from her was a blank stare. So I realized that I needed to step up my parenting, and I wrote a novel.
Uh-huh. And this was not the novel. It was another novel?
No, it was Life on Nubis was a novel.
This was a novel. My goodness. Now, when you started writing, because business and technical writing, again, very linear. Sometimes people will incorporate a story here and there. But if anybody like me has read technical materials or contracts, you sort of go a blur after a while because it's very dry. Academia uses terminology that you figure you've got to have a dictionary that's about 4 feet thick to be able to find the words that are put in there. And it just, I don't know, it just seems like it lacks so much. But your book, Life on Nubis, incorporates so much emotion. It incorporates thinking processes, but it brings in all of these different personalities and a time frame. Now, is this around 2022? Is that about the time frame that you're looking at with this?
2040 was when they leave Earth to emigrate to the new planet.
Okay.
And that's about the time where I and others in the technology field believe that the technological singularity will occur, and that is where computers achieve the general intelligence equivalent to humans.
Fascinating. Now, with this, you open up your book. You have a woman by the, you know, that is waking somebody up. And these are the words, people of Earth, you no longer suffer sickness, hunger, or want for anything. The golden age of humanity dawns. Now, with those words, there's a picture that can form in one's mind. And you think this is going to be an absolutely glorious something that you're opening up to. For centuries, there's been the talk about the golden age. Well, depending on where you are in life, you may have experienced what you feel is a golden age, or you may feel like the world is just a hellhole of hellholes. So this is something, though, that in the next couple of sentences, there's a statement about a coiled robotic arm tightening around Aiden. And this is one of your characters. And he says, you'll never feel machine. So just in line with what you were discussing, that it's anticipated by those of you in the techie world, that by 2040, 44, 50, whatever, you were supposed to have these super intelligent computers that are going to be able to think and to reason and to do all kinds of things. And that's what your book opens up with. Who's Aiden, and what did you base this character on?
So Aiden is one of the two primary protagonists or heroes in the story. And he is really he's a person that is struggling to deal with the technological change. And part of his background, he's an environmental engineer, and so that's how I brought in my knowledge of biology. And he's able to understand and interact with the ecosystem on the new planet, which is also based on biology. And so Aiden's struggle really represents what I believe most people, including myself, will go through as this rapid technology changes how we have to interact with society and our world.
Well, I find it intriguing that this robot that's talking with Aiden is demanding a payment of money, which was 4/1,000th of a cent, activate your credentials to pay. And of course, he doesn't have any money to pay, and then he's tossed into a pit. So the robots have gotten to a point, and of course, there's a lot of science fiction writers, including Arthur C. Clarke, who have written about the same thing, intelligent robots. But this is a robot that's got programming you cannot communicate with, you can't barter with, and he's just tossed out like a piece of waste material to be recycled. And like you said, he has this tremendous war. And what it is that he ends up embarking on a journey because these robots are telling him what to do, how to do it. And it reminds me of some people I know. There is really not a comprehensive thinking process. But the conceptualizations that you have here is that this is something that human beings are going to have to deal with because they will have designed this distortion. It's all back to human thinking. And here you've got these little components of business to your background. This is what you're supposed to do. This is how you're supposed to do it. And yet it is devoid of any kind of feeling, of any kind of emotion. And that's one of the things that you bring out in this book. Do you feel that in today's world we already are developing this disassociation with communication among each other?
I do. You know, if you walk down a major street of any city during a noon lunch hour, you'll notice that the pedestrians on the sidewalk, most of them are staring at their smartphones. They're not even looking at traffic when they cross the intersection. And I'm frankly kind of amazed that more people don't get hit by cars. And if you put down your cell phone and you just walk around and look at people, no one is making eye contact. They're always staring at that small screen. And I think that that trend will continue. And you mentioned the lack of emotions. And without, you know, a constant interpersonal interaction, our emotions can, you know, shrink, just like your muscles if you don't use them. You become detached from yourself. And these robots that we create, these intelligent machines, they won't have the capacity for emotion that we have because they're purely a logic, electronic organism. And so we'll be interacting with them on a logical basis, and they won't have the same sorts of rules or decision metrics. And, you know, the beginning of the story that you brought out is very interesting because it sets up the context of this world. I mean, there's the potential for a lot of good things to happen, but, you know, if robots replace humans in all the jobs, you know, how are people going to have money to buy things? And that's why Aiden, all he needed was a fraction of a cent to save his life, and he didn't have it. So they tossed him away, you know, and that notion of tossing away, I mean, what do you do with an old computer, you know, that's 10 years old and you no longer have a use for it? Well, you throw it in the trash. There's nothing to do with it. You can't use it. Are human beings going to become that old computer in the future because we're not as smart or as efficient or logical as these new machines?
When you look at history, we have gone through cycles, not with robotic technology, where human life was devalued tremendously, and where if you didn't fit the norm, you were tossed. And so I find the correlation in the new concept of relating with computers, the very same thing, but a whole different level of costuming, which you bring together very well. And you talk about colony ships delivering their passengers to their destination world with minimal human intervention. And I think of some of the sci-fi movies where these, like in Star Trek, what's on the planet? How do you evaluate? As humans, can we be on this planet? Will it kill us? What's the atmosphere like? Can we eat anything? And I think of Gene Roddenberry and the things that he put out, the concepts that were written and promoted by different physicists that he interacted with for his script. And I just thought, yes, this is really a fascinating book, Life on Nubis, because there is this planet that they end up going to. And they're in this real old colony ship. And they're sent out. And it's sort of like a form of a time travel, if you will, because they're put into suspension. But then they have some challenges because he's brought back, and there is a captain of a ship. He's got a whole load of people that he's carrying, a Captain Walker. He is carrying all of these people, and how he makes a choice about who he's going to activate. And this is intriguing because, again, why is someone considered valuable? And Aiden is sort of an odd duck, yet they bring him forth. How come?
Because he had the environmental skills or training to assess whether the planet was habitable. So it's really, he was valued by his knowledge. And they revived another woman who was an electrical engineer, and she was valued again for expert skills. But then there was a, you know, a third passenger who, by accident, had to be revived. And the choice was either to let him die or put him back in suspension, which was a risky gambit. And there was a debate because this individual was a baker, and he didn't have any skills relevant to their immediate crisis situation. And I think one of the things that's interesting and subtle about that dynamic is that, you know, are we just valuing people based on their technical knowledge? Because that's going to become less important in the future as intelligent machines do more of our technical thinking for us. Or is there, you know, more intrinsic value in the human being as a person?
That being said, there is a sentence I'll quote out of your book where Aidan says people should be measured on their worth, not their cost. And he has a whole different mindset from the general disposition of the environment that he has been brought up in. And this has all been stimulated by observation. He is a thinker, and he challenges things. And you bring out a term, singularity, and there's a question that's posed. Are you running from singularity? What is singularity?
So singularity is the moment that computers achieve general intelligence with human beings. And what do I mean by that? Well, there's an easy test for that. A person cannot tell the difference between a computer and another person when they're interacting. And that means that the computer is smart enough, not just in doing calculations or reasoning, but, you know, mimicking emotions, expressions, judgment, learning, all those things that we think about as capabilities that a person does and differentiates us from other animals on the planet. You know, we have a consciousness. That's what the singularity is. Computers become an artificial life form.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also go into this phenomenal experience of them landing on a planet that has trees, it has oxygen, there is the capability of being able to live on this planet, to sustain it. So the ship lands, but it's a very, very unique world. Its ecological systems are unlike anything that any of them have ever experience. And the trees have a particular patterning to them. There's so many different things that go on here. When I was reading this, I was so intrigued by the way you were handling the ecological environment that I really wondered what stimulated this for you? What was it in the natural world? Because you've had this background in the environment and in research and studying different creatures and different forms of life. What was it that created this in your head? Was there something from the natural world that you said, I can create this, and then you made it bigger than what you knew?
There was, and that's very insightful. So I did draw upon my biological science training for a lot of the principles that connect the different organisms. The inspiration for the overall ecosystem and the trees that you mentioned was actually from hiking in the redwoods, the giant sequoia forests, and here in the Pacific Northwest where I live, the immense trees that we have. They're all inspiring, and they put me as a human being in my place, so to speak, and then I'm a much smaller piece of the world than I think of myself normally. But then I started with that, you know, that logical premise, but then I let my creativity run wild, and some of the creatures in the world there, while they have some logical science sense, they're actually metaphors for different aspects of how we live. For example, one of the metaphors describes in a very indirect way the madness that we see in crowds on Black Friday, fighting to get the last little trinket that's on sale. And, you know, it really reflects a part of humanity that can be quite ugly at times and harmful for people. So I kind of went crazy after I got the science down to make the world much more imaginative, creative, and say more things.
Well, it's so it's so intriguing to me because the way you use your words, and with life on Nubis, which is this planet that the ship has landed on, it is an adaptation process. There needs to be a curiosity. There needs to be an investigative positioning, and yet the Captain Walker wants to apply the old school methodology, which is very reflective even of the times that we're living in today. The thinking pattern, what I consider the 1940s medieval, you can lump them all together, cycles of history which people want to hang on to, say this is the way we do things. This is what worked in the past. Well, it doesn't. It really doesn't. You can take excerpts from it, but you've got to reconstitute what may be of value from the old and put it into a healthier picture for the new. Otherwise, it's very destructive. And so we have this patterning that's going on right now in life, and that's what you present, even though this is, a long time ahead in the future. The same patterns exist within the human character, and human character is pretty consistent in maintaining the old modalities. And that's what I was seeing with this Captain Walker. And that is what I saw you trying to convey, because Aiden was in direct opposition with Captain Walker because he had a very militaristic approach to things. It was either black or white. Aiden knew that this wasn't the case because of his background. You have to look at things differently. You have to be able to see what is really there. And he became aware of the fact that they were in this new environment, and that environment was being destroyed by them. This was really intriguing, very intriguing to me because of the conceptualization that you brought forward. For example, I'll read a sentence. One of the trees stood bleak, still death for a moment, before collapsing into dust. Aiden was totally perplexed by this. It wasn't anything that was in his experience. And this was a big clue as to what was going to be needed, what one had to learn to be able to live on this planet, a planet with two suns. Did you share this story with your daughter, and what did she think of it?
I did share it with her. In fact, I read it to her. At the time, she was 9 years old when I first read the story to her, and so the reading level was a little bit higher grade level than she was able to read on her own, but she really enjoyed it, and she's 11 now, and so she's started reading it on her own, and she's mm-hmm. asking for a sequel. So I take that as a positive reaction.
Oh, I agree. Now, there's also a love story that's woven in here, but I found that you, in this story's tapestry, have integrated so many minute details of what I'd call the linear thinking and observations that you've made from your various background of experiences, that in the sci-fi depiction of this other world that eventually becomes the world that human beings can live on, they understand the adaptation they need to go through, and I'm not going to give away the secrets, but it's really fascinating how you have taken what you have learned and woven it into this, and just some fascinating perspectives about computers. And there's two female computers here, both that play a significant role, and I didn't like either one of them. Being a female, I didn't like either one of these gals. And they each had been programmed with their own agendas. And I thought, that's an interesting perspective, because there isn't a human being that doesn't have some kind of a blueprint that they come in with, personality-wise. But these were directives created by human beings. Where did you pull that out from?
So the two characters that you're speaking of were actually a speculation on my part on where the technology will go. But I think, thinking more broadly about the characters, in particular their genders, it's interesting. I really wanted to write a novel that had strong female characters. Because, you know, I want my daughter to believe that she is capable of achieving anything that she sets her mind to in life. And I think that's very important to be enabling and supportive, and for both boys and girls to have positive self-esteem. And so the two, you know, heroes of the book, the one is the father, Aiden, and the other, the heroine, is his daughter. And they, you know, they do represent kind of the positive side. But you know, as you mentioned, everyone brings a history, you know, a background, a blueprint. And, you know, within each of us, there's both good and bad. And so these two, you know, computer entities that are female, you know, display that. You know, they show that, you know, technology is really a tool, and a tool can be used for good or evil. I mean, it's what we make do with the tool. And so there is an element of free will. And I also wanted to convey the message that we really need to look forward in time and not retrospectively. You mentioned Commander Walker being a very black and white thinker, and he is, and it's very rewarding to hear all the insights you've gleaned from the book. That's very exciting for me. And, you know, people do have a tendency to look at the past and think the future is going to look like the past. But, you know, these computer life forms will really change the playing field, and they'll have different ways of thinking, and how they bring their history and translate it to this new world is going to be quite different than what we've seen in the past. And so I wanted to make sure that people start thinking about the future.
Robert, I was intrigued in your book how you talk about one of your characters, Sarah, the daughter, but she had intuitive perspective. And you make a statement in your book, women of ages past had harnessed and honed the powers of relating and influencing. Sarah's ancestors had passed this gift to their daughters in an unbroken line of survival to her. And you also go into some fascinating aspects about medical technology, because there are people that get injured and they have these little itsy-bitsy nanorobots. They have their medical kits where these little robotic items can be put in. They can rebuild cells. They can heal bones. They deal with the life force of a human being in a phenomenal way. And, of course, this technology has been worked on, I think, for at least 50 years now. There have been people that have had this conceptualization for a long time. I think there was a movie made about a submarine that was designed that was so tiny that went through a person's body system. I don't remember the name of it, but I remember hearing about it and conversation about it and people saying, oh, that's science fiction. Well, my goodness, we're evolving towards that. This is something where the technology of being able to diagnose the body differently and to be able to do repair work differently is evolving. And this is something that you bring out in your book. Is this something that you gained from your own research when you were putting details together? Did you actually find that there were those universities, et cetera, those labs that were doing exactly this kind of study?
Yes, I did. Actually, there's basic research that is going on right now in corporations, universities, and research centers that are really proving the feasibility of this technology. And they're coming from three different fields: biotechnology, nanotechnology, which is the technology of the very small that you mentioned, and artificial intelligence and robotics. And there have been advances, some pretty amazing advances in the past several years that have really proved this concept that we'll be able to have these nanorobots that will be able to go into our body and repair damage to our tissues and organs. It's quite exciting, actually, from a health perspective.
It really is, and that's what you present in the book. You present these concepts. And, of course, Dad, Aiden, he really wants to encourage his family to understand and accept this environment. And, of course, his daughter has this empathetic relationship with the environment that's phenomenal. And there are the watchers that she's very aware of. She's never been afraid of them. She really understands them. And I think this is a book that shows that many times that there is a connection with different life forms that people have. The Native Americans speak of this frequently, to listen, to watch, to absorb, to be one-on-one with the natural environment that you're in so that you can become empowered and that you can really hear the voice of nature. And you've incorporated that in this sci-fi, Life on Nubis, that takes us into this realm of a whole different planetary environment, a planet with two suns, a planet that has life forms that none of the humans have ever seen before, and learning how to adapt and to adjust to the environment they're in. And when you bring it into the context of our world today, look at how many things that we've done that we've found out that really weren't so smart, that we're actually damaging our environment. And now we're having to become innovative to be able to take care of this planet that we live on so that we can live better lives and we can do things in a more efficient and effective way. And I felt your story, Life on Nubis, has a phenomenal parallel with the world that we're experiencing today, that there is a lot that you dish out in this book, and it is fascinating, just from the beginning to the end. And I agree with your daughter. I think you need to write a sequel to this, to carry it forward into another level, because I think those that will want to read it are going to find them saying, what's next? Where do we go from here? Robert.
Thank you. Thank you, Donna. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Your website is roberthaarken.com. That's Robert, H-A-R-K-E-N. When people go to your website, what are they going to find?
So they'll find a free sample chapter of the book. They'll find more information about the novel, where to purchase it, ebook or paperback online, or you can order it through your local bookstore. And they'll find more information about me.
With this book, are you finding that people are as intrigued with the future as you are?
I really have had a positive reaction to it, and a lot of people are very curious about where we're headed and what the implications of these new technologies will mean. So, yes, I mean, it's very encouraging to see that people are really starting to think about the future, and the story has helped them to frame questions. That's quite amazing to me.
Well, if you like mystery, if you want to dip into the future, if you want to go forth into a paradigm of thinking that's never been explored by you before, I think you'll find Life on Nubis an intriguing book to read, and one that will cause you to think about things maybe a little differently than what you had ever imagined. Robert Haarken, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today, and be sure to let me know when you come out with your sequel.
I will, Donna. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Life on Nubis. Robert Haarken has been my guest. We're going to take a quick break for just a moment, and we'll be back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number, if you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, here is the toll-free number, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I love science fiction, don't you? I just think that people's imaginations, their minds, are so intriguing. Here you had someone that's so linear in everything that he's done in life, and he has just gone 180 degrees, yet he folded in a lot of the wisdoms that he's acquired and all of this wonderful, wonderful flow of design, characterization, action. It's just, it's fascinating. And that is what makes life a rich experience, when you can journey along with someone's visualization of possibilities. Heck, Gene Roddenberry did that, and look at how it keeps going and going and going, just like the Energizer Bunny. Speaking about going, going, and going, how would you like to be able to become more efficient with different components in your life? Now, some of this is a little whimsical, but some of it's going to be very, very practical. If you're a traveler, like I have been for many years, and especially if you're a business traveler, and in today's world, you've got to make sure that you pack smarter. I can remember the days when I had to carry my own luggage through snow when I'd go up to Alaska, and today that's no longer the case. Today we have all of this wonderful change that's occurred in so many airports where your luggage is transported. We've got luggage with wheels on it. And I think back and I go, how in the world did I ever manage all of those bags? Well, packing more efficiently, traveling more efficiently, because I guarantee you, years ago, I wasn't that efficient in my traveling. I can remember bringing back bags of goodies, of things that I had picked up on various trips, and I was very glad to be able to do it. But in today's world, hey, you have to pay for the bags being taken care of. And at $20, $30, with some airlines, it's $40 a bag. It gets to be a bit pricey. Well, if you really want to be efficient in your packing, there is a sack. It's called Pack It Compression Sack Set. It's a polyethylene nylon grouping of bags. They have one-way air valves at the bottom, and you can roll up your bulky clothes, even pillows, and you can reduce their volume by 80%. Now, we've seen all of this. You can go into any of your box stores, and you can find this for your coverlets, et cetera. But usually, they recommend you use a vacuum, so you suck the air out. Well, you're not going to have a vacuum with you in your suitcase. So these kinds of bags can really make for very, very efficient packing, and it's something that's very handy. And I know I had a girlfriend up in Alaska. Her husband would go off on hunting trips, and they'd put stuff in plastic bags. And she said, I just press it down. Well, they did that because many times when he was out in the wilderness and doing the hunting, he could be exposed to water. I mean, it could rain, do all kinds of things. So this has a value on more than one level. It's also a good thing to use if you have something that has liquid in it in your bag. It also gives you that extra protection that allows to keep things from getting wet, like maybe you have some hairspray or you have some kind of lotion or a liquid soap of some kind. We all have our preferences of what we want to use when we travel. So this is a very good item to have. Also, you know, one of the things that's happening that we are noticing is that efficiency is coming up more and more with packaging. To be able to get everything out of a container product, whether it's a lotion, a shampoo, a food item, whatever it might be, packaging often leaves 3 to 25% of whatever the contents might be behind. Now, if it's a dry cereal, that's not the case. But how many times have you opened up a container and you go, gee whiz, here's this little bitty bag or this little bitty something in there, and here's all this vacuum of space? Well, there are a lot of people in the packaging industry that are saying, let's condense it. Costs will come down. Let's make the packaging more efficient so that there isn't the waste and so that it doesn't have to take up as much space. All of this is evolving. This is something that they are dealing with. So there is a new item called a Every Drop Beauty Spatula for ladies when it comes to scooping goop from any size of lotion, lipstick, shampoo, or mascara bottle or tube. And it's something, it's a little tiny flexible tool that allows women to get the full use of the product that's there. And there's so many other areas that the product packaging, is changing and making a difference. Tax season. This is coming up. Now, if you have to be audited, you need to remember they have a lot of discretion about how they handle various cases. Now, I'm going to share some information with you that's been passed along by Scott Estill. He worked for the IRS at one time. He was an attorney. And he said, if you end up getting audited, number one, don't go in with an antagonistic attitude. You don't want to show up late, and you don't want to miss a deadline. Auditors are not happy. You want to be sure that you schedule your appointment with them before a weekend or an extended holiday. You don't want to book them after a weekend or extended holiday. And he said, you always, when you go in for an audit, dress conservatively. Never give the impression that you're making more than your tax return shows. Now, why in the world would that make a difference? It's human psychology. Dress appropriately. Don't go in cutoffs. Be conservative in your dress. Always call your auditor Mr. or Ms. Respect is appreciated. You don't need to be afraid. And he said, don't instigate small talk yourself. Wait for the auditor to instigate it himself or herself. And if he says to you, for example, I see you made a donation to a college, follow up with some kind of a positive comment, like, yes, I'm supporting my alma mater. Where did you go to school? The more an auditor likes you, the better the result will be in most cases. Now, sometimes you're going to get a sour grapefruit. But generally, if you just remember, auditors are people. They really have a tough time. They've got to deal with numbers that you don't even want to be bothered with. That's why we have bookkeepers and CPAs. We want them to do this stuff most of the time. So be aware. Tax season is here. If you find you're going to be audited, don't be terrified. Realize that you can handle it, and it can work out in a positive way for you. Human communication, not a smartphone, thank you very much. Human communication makes a big difference. Donna Sebo here. We're going to take a break for just a moment. 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into. And I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. When we come back, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and maybe some more. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a minute.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call into is 888-627-6008. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with a woman by the name of Lori Beck. Lori is a stage 4 cancer survivor. And what this woman did, what she accomplished, and what she's passing on in her book, I'm Living to Tell, is really going to impress you. She was a woman that decided to walk in a different path, a different direction of being able to deal with, for what most people would think, would be a death verdict. And again, she's living to tell it. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking with Travis Waters, a West Coast kid. Travis is a man that entered a world that I'm telling you I would never recommend to anyone, nor does he. But he entered this dark world. His story, West Coast Kid, is about his life and how he switched from an underworld of ugliness to one that is making other people's lives, especially those of young people, a whole lot better. And then we're going to be talking about money. Appropriate. That's going to be on Thursday because we're going to be talking about the courage to be profitable. Ruth King, if you want to run a business, if you want to be in business, if you have a business that is not doing so hot, courage, do you believe you have it? If not, do you want to find out how you can become profitable? Ruth is going to share it. Her little book is a powerful one and one that can really benefit you. Advice is for winners. Raul Valdez Perez. How can we get advice to really empower us? Do we know the right questions to ask? We're going to find out on Friday. This and much more is coming up on the Donna Sebo Show. I also want to let you know that all of the postings for my upcoming guests are there under show information, and you can go there and find out what you need to know about the upcoming guests. I invite you to tell your friends and share with them the wonderful people that we have on this show that are meant to empower your life. Speaking about people empowering others' lives, there is a woman that I think has done something that is so incredibly positive. And I really enjoy sharing stories about people who, out of the blue, do something and it has this phenomenal ripple effect that touches people's lives in an incredible way. Hannah Brecher is her name, and she had graduated from college and moved to a new city, and she was going after a job in communications, and she was supposed to be having an adventure. She was in a big city. This is supposed to be wonderful. This was part of her dream, to be able to be out in the big world around a lot of people. She was 22 years old. She felt like she was drowning. She absolutely felt like she was drowning. Not only that, but she was scared. Now, Hannah happened to be somewhere at a bus stop, and she was waiting for her transportation in this huge city, millions of people all around her, going a mile a minute. She felt so alone. Well, she looks over, and seated on the same bench is another woman. This woman has circles under her eyes, their eyes connected, and Hannah noticed that this woman looked so exhausted. Now, she was older than Hannah. And Hannah suddenly felt this tremendous compassion inside. She took out a notebook that she had in her book and started writing a letter of encouragement. And this woman happened to be wearing a red...
Caller line 3.
Well, I'll be sharing the rest of this story with you, but we're going to take a caller right now. Welcome to the show, caller. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Hi, Donna. My initial is JL, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From Brooklyn. Oh, it should be just absolutely gorgeous there right now. Brooklyn is beautiful in spring.
It is.
Well, down to business with you, JL. First thing that I am getting in mind is don't tell everybody your business. What I am seeing, I'm seeing an image of you. It's sort of like a cartoonish type of an image. And you're talking a mile a minute. And you're just talking. And the persons that are hearing you talk, they're listening, and whatever you are expressing, you're wanting to just vent. But they're not necessarily hearing the substance of what you're trying to communicate. And so there may be some misinterpretation. You need to be discerning as to who you vent with or vent to. Don't be indiscriminate in this. If you're at work, don't do it at work. You can be very, very selective because someone is going to invariably say something that could end up coming back like a whiplash and affecting you in a very unpleasant way. So you need to be very discerning. And a good thing that you could do for yourself is to write. And make sure that if you have a journal, you don't leave it out so someone else can pick it up and read it. You want to make sure that it's going to be in a safe place, that it's for your eyes only. It's very important that you find a way to relieve some of your tension, because if you don't, you're going to find that something is going to bite you back. So be alert, be aware, because there seems to be a lot of frustration that's going on. And again, we all need to vent. There's nothing wrong with that, but be wise here. Do you have a quick question for me?
I guess my question is related to what you just said. I feel like I always try my best to be nice to everyone around me, but then somehow there are always people around me that are dislike me for whatever reason. And it's not because I've been rude to them. I don't know why, and I try to surround myself with positive people, but you know, negative people just keep coming into my life, and it seems to be like a theme, you know, that I keep getting into.
All right. Let me make a suggestion to you that someone passed along to me a long time ago. When someone comes into your life, your perception is that they're not so positive. One, don't try to figure things out. Ask yourself instead the question, what is this person here to teach me? Now, sometimes the lesson is you stand up to them. They may have a lousy, stinking attitude. I think of someone that I encountered just recently that they had a terrible attitude. They don't know how to manage their mouth. They have a way of speaking that just cuts people down to nubs unless you look at them and just say, excuse me, but this is not appropriate. Or we'll talk about this in a different way. You have to take charge. You're trying to pacify everybody. You can't do that. You can, but it's a waste of time. You need to be able to accept people for who they are and what they are. If it is something that's not compatible with you, if you're in a situation to remove yourself from it, fine. Sometimes you may have to say, this is inappropriate. Would you explain to me why you've said this? And not be afraid. Not be afraid of them. So perhaps the lesson is here to get rid of fear. You are not here to please everybody on this planet. Nobody can. You're always going to have people that are going to be jealous of you, not like you. That's just human nature. It's how you deal with it that makes a difference. And that's what you are in the process of learning. And so this is going to build your strength. It's going to build your character. Don't feel like you have to compromise to placate someone that just is not able to communicate well or effectively. And there are some people that have stinking thinking. My dear, I'm out of time. I'm going to have to go. But trust yourself more. And don't worry about trying to please the world. It is never going to happen. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, we're out of time. It's been delightful. I'm so glad you've joined me today. Won't you join me again tomorrow to hear a real story about a real woman? And I'll tell you more about Hannah tomorrow. We've run out of time. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. God bless. Have a magnificent day, even though it is April Fool's. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.